From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. We're at a milestone this week, people. 200 episodes. I can't believe we're at 200 episodes. This whole thing started on a lark. I was in an elevator right here at ABC News headquarters in New York City a couple years ago, and one of my friends, longtime colleague, Lauren Efron, she got onto the elevator, and I said to her, do we do podcasts here at ABC News? She works in digital, which I thought maybe had something to do with the podcast division, which, of course, it doesn't. The radio folks do the podcasts. Anyway, the answer was, we really didn't have a podcast. But Lauren is such a high-energy person that she, a couple days later, she organized a meeting with some folks from the digital department and the radio world, and they were in my office, and everybody was like, yeah, let's try doing a podcast. And so a couple weeks later, we had a podcast. I interviewed the Dalai Lama. I had a pre-scheduled interview with the Dalai Lama. We dumped that into the podcast feed, and then I set something up with Rivers Cuomo from Weezer, who's a friend of a friend, and boom, we launched the podcast with those two, and every week since then, we've been somehow wrangling guests into the studio to sit and talk to me about meditation, and it has been amazing. I've learned an extraordinary amount, and I continue to learn from all of you. As some of you may know, we have this amazing group of podcast insiders, hundreds of people who give us feedback every week. And so I'm, you know, continually trying to up my game. And this has been an incredible run. And to mark the occasion, we have brought back the legendary meditation teacher, Sharon Salzberg, who has been on this show more than any other person for good reason, because she's an extraordinary human being who's gotten an extraordinary life story and has been a teacher who's touched the lives of tens of thousands of people. She's written a series of best-selling books and is one of the founding teachers on the 10% Happier app. And she happens to be on the other side, thankfully, of a really serious health crisis. I mentioned this on the show a few months ago, that went when she was in the throes of this and she was in the hospital in California. And there was a big outpouring of support and love for her. But I wanted to bring her on. I sent her an email when she arrived back in New York after she got out of the hospital, and said, would you be willing to come on the show and talk about it? Because I thought it would be useful for people. We're all going to get sick. We're all going to die. And I thought it would be useful for people to hear what it's like to be in a situation where death is a very real possibility. And you've spent decades of your life training your mind in meditation. So Sharon really, in this episode, walks us blow by blow through this ordeal, and we get a fascinating window into what it was like in her head as she was enduring this. One quick little plug here before we get into the episode, and that is that she's one of the most popular teachers on the 10% Happier app, and there is a great meditation I want to highlight here. It's one she guides on doing loving kindness meditation while walking, and she describes it as a kind of silent secret superpower that can be applied as you walk through the world. So if you go to the On the Go category on the app and click on her meditations, you can find it there. We've also put a direct link in the show notes. All right, back to Sharon Salzberg. I want to thank her for all she's done for me as a teacher and for the bravery that this interview really entailed, as you're about to hear. Oh, and one more thing before we go here. We're going to do voicemails this week, but Sharon's going to do them. And we recorded these separately, so the audio will sound a little different, but Sharon's going to take your voicemails at the end of the show. So stay tuned for that. Here we go. Sharon Salzberg. Nice to see you.
It's very nice to see you.
A lot of people were really worried about you when the news broke. But I can tell them, because they can't see you, that you look great.
Thank you.
And I've seen you a couple times over the last few weeks and months, and you're up and about and doing your thing. But I wanted to have you in. You already were the most frequent guest on the show, but I wanted to have you in again because I'm interested in how does a meditation, somebody who's been meditating for this long with so much intensity, handle a health crisis of the likes of which you just endured. So can we start at the beginning? What happened here?
What happened? What happened to me? Well, there was some amazing strokes of luck all along the way. You know, I had great good fortune as well. I was staying with some friends, and I was staying in their guest house, which was down the hill from their house, which would have meant I would have been alone if all that followed had happened down there. But I happened to be in their actual house. And
In California.
And I was flying back the next day, I thought, to New York. And
you were out there teaching meditation?
Yeah, I had taught in L.A., I taught in San Francisco, and then I was just visiting my friends. And in their house, I sort of I went into some altered state of consciousness. I was shivering. I was shaking, and it wasn't unpleasant. You know, I had it was fascinating. I just thought, wow, this is so interesting. And I'm like tripping. This is so weird. And then I must have passed out. And
were you standing up at the time?
No, I was on their couch and lying on their couch. But then I got up to go to the bathroom, and that's when I collapsed. And I kind of came to on their couch again, and there was a stranger looking down at me who was an ambulance driver, and he said, I'm here to take you to the hospital. And I was so confused, like, why do I have to go to the hospital? I'm having a fine time, you know, just exploring these other realms of consciousness. And
Had you been actively exploring other realms?
Yeah. I mean, I was just out there, you know, and subjectively, I was just shivering and shaking. That's all anybody could see. And I was just like, wow, this is kind of cool.
Subjectively to the other people in the room?
I should say physically. You know, the symptom was that I was shivering and shaking, but I was not suffering. I didn't feel ill.
Did you know you were shivering and shaking?
Yeah. I knew I was shivering and shaking, but then I thought I was having some experience. So
just to put that in perspective, people who've meditated a lot, and some people who haven't meditated that much, have quite interesting experiences.
Yeah.
In particular, there's this practice known as jhana practice, where you get very focused, and this is going to sound pretty far out, although we've talked about it on the show before. You actually are able to walk into these kind of interconnected rooms in the mind.
Yeah.
I'm stealing that phraseology from somebody else, where it's pretty far out. And there's a lot of people have done this, this practice. It's not something, you know, supernatural. And did you think that's what was going on, something along those lines?
The term jhana didn't come to my mind, but I would have these thoughts like, wow, this is kind of like reading my DNA or something. This is really far out.
You know? And you weren't freaked out by the fact that all of a sudden you were sitting on a couch 1 minute and the next minute you're shivering and shaking and also like looking at your own DNA?
No. That part didn't. I mean, my friend was rubbing my leg, you know, it felt like a massage. I thought, oh, this is just some release of something, you know, something is just happening. I didn't.
A release of some sort of energy or something?
Yeah.
Like that? Okay. Again, I'll just put that in perspective because to the untrained ear, that's going to sound out there. But in meditation, you know, people sweat or move involuntarily all the time. And actually having an energy release like that is not uncommon.
Yeah. No, it's not uncommon. And so I didn't think, you know, this is toxicity or I'm ill or get me to the hospital or anything. So, in fact, when this guy looked down at me and said, I'm here to take you to the hospital, I'm an ambulance driver, he said, is that okay? And I looked at my friends, like, so confused, like, why do I have to go to the hospital? And then I realized I couldn't remember their names. Mm. And I thought, oh, I have to go to the hospital. And I have zero recollection of the ambulance ride. What had happened was that I was getting septicemia just then. It was like overcoming me. The bacteria that had been in my body, actually in my leg, which nobody knew about, including me, burst into my bloodstream. And so it was just like taking over. So
septicemia. So is it septic shock?
Yeah. I don't, it's like, it's being septic. It's having sepsis and I don't know at what point the line is where one says, oh, now you're in septic shock. I was pretty shocky because I was, you know, I was unconscious. But as you had said in a conversation we had earlier, you know, I was never intubated. I mean, I hear a lot of stories about people with sepsis that are far worse. But still, I was gonzo, you know. And so I kind of came to somewhat later in the evening in the emergency room still, and the same ambulance driver was there. He'd already gone out and picked up someone else and brought them in, and he poked his head in, and he said, boy, you look a lot better. You looked awful when we brought you in. And then there was a lot of effort. You know, they put me on IV antibiotics, but there was a lot of effort to find the original source of the infection so they could target the antibiotics, which took a while. So they gave me a bunch of chest x-rays because they thought I must have pneumonia, which I did not have. And they admitted me to ICU. And it was the next day when an infectious disease doctor came in that she saw like this really small little place on my leg. And she said, oh, that's it. And she was right.
Well, how did it happen?
Nobody knows. They asked me a lot of questions. A lot of people said, did you have a pedicure? Pedicures are famous, which I thought, never again. they said, you might have banged your leg on an airplane. You know, you got a scratch. Something happened that I was just unaware of. And it just, what was odd was that once they got the right antibiotics and then the bacteria started leaving my bloodstream, it kind of went home to my leg, which swelled up like I had elephantiasis. And it was really disgusting, my poor leg. But it was interesting watching it come home in that way.
One thing I'm hearing in your voice is I'm hearing you tell the story, and I don't know if it's just because there's enough distance now, but I'm not hearing a lot of fear, panic. You seem pretty calm about it.
Well,
were you calm in the moment?
Was I calm in the moment? Not as calm as I am now.
Okay.
You know, I wouldn't say I was panicked, but I was, you know, in answer in part to your implied question, I feel like I was supported by my practice throughout, not in a conscious or strained way, like, oh, I better calm down, I better start breathing or something. But it was there. My first nurse in ICU was actually also an acupuncturist. I was in Santa Cruz. You know, so right away, we know everyone's kind of hip, you know. so the nurse was an acupuncturist in Santa Cruz. And he said, so he kind of knew who I was. And he said at one point, your lips are really chapped. I'm going to go get you a chapstick. And I said to my friend, isn't that sweet? He's going to give me a chapstick. And then I said, well, probably not giving it to me. It's probably going to cost me $65, you know. And I look back at that and I think, how could my mind have done that? You know, like been detached enough to be funny. I mean, there I am in ICU, you know, like, and yet there was something. And the next day when the infectious disease doctor came in, she said to me, boy, I didn't know what I was going to find in here because your numbers are really bad. Like your white blood cell count is through the roof, but you seem much better than your numbers. And I really honestly feel that that was my practice, you know, that that was sustaining me and giving me a way of looking at my experience that was strong. That's not to say I was never scared. I mean, I was scared. I was scared about different things at different times, you know, because there were scary things at different times, different ones. You know, there were moments when people would say, well, you know, this kind of bacteria really likes to go into the heart, so we have to give you an echocardiogram. And so it hadn't gone into my heart. I had another echocardiogram later, hadn't gone into my heart. Or people would say, well, this kind of bacteria really likes to go into the bones, so we've got to give you a CAT scan, you know, give me a CAT scan. Hadn't gone into my bones. And my white blood cell count just came steadily down. The really kind of initial scary thing I remember is that it was so foggy and my head was just cloudy. And I thought, maybe this is it, you know, like maybe I'm not going to write another book or speak, or I'm just going to be in a room kind of mellow, you know, but hopefully, you know, I certainly didn't have mental acuity. I was forgetting people's names, or I was like, just kind of, you know, still reading my DNA a little bit, I guess, you know, somewhere.
well,
somewhere else. So that was scary.
Well, reading your DNA to me seems like you're in a high state of meditation, which would entail mental acuity, whereas the fogginess seems to be kind of the opposite of meditation.
Well, I think the fogginess was because I had to function, not highly function, but I had to respond to people's questions, or I had to know how to ask for something, or and function in a system. You know, I got out of ICU, I was in a room, and, you know, so it was a little bit like, I have to learn this culture. I have to know how to make things work here. And it was just like, you know, and I wasn't non-functional, but I was not as bright as I might have wished by any means.
Must be that, I would imagine, would be scary, given that you'd spent decades cultivating awareness, wakefulness.
Yeah, no, that was scary. That was like, that was really a low point in the whole situation. It was just kind of like, oh, because my mind did, my thoughts did what we do, which one really has to be careful of, which was I projected it into the future. This is going to be the way it is, maybe. You know, this is how I'm going to function for the rest of my life. Or, that life is gone, you know, and so I didn't quite have the energy. I mean, I did to some extent, you know, thank goodness. But it was only a little later. I couldn't sleep in the hospital bed because it was too uncomfortable. The other thing that happened is that I got diagnosed with sleep apnea when I was in there because I would stop breathing, and this team of people, I had a heart monitor on, people would come running in, you know, like, and then they'd wake me up and I'd go, what? What? And so between the machine and, you know, the whole thing, I couldn't sleep in the hospital bed. So I was sleeping in this old rickety armchair in the room. And I had to keep my leg elevated, which meant both legs elevated with that particular recliner. So, and that bottom part kept falling down because it was so old and rickety. So at one point I thought, oh, you know what? There's that stool off in the corner of the room. And if we take the stool and we prop it up, you know, that bottom part, it's not going to fall down anymore. And then I thought, my brain is back.
Huh.
Now it's back. And that was actually a turning point.
How long were you in the hospital?
I was there for 10 days.
And did it progressively get better from the moment you entered, or were there times when, you know, new problems emerged and you thought, oh, no, we're in a worse place now?
It was a lot of up and down because at some point, you know, you're trying to survive the hospital. You're trying to survive the system. You know, like, I guess when I got to the emergency room, they pumped me full of fluids because that's what they do to try to keep your blood pressure from crashing and your organs from failing. And then they had to give me diuretics to get rid of the fluid. And then at one point, the diuretics gave me gout. So there
Why's
I am.
Gout?
Gout is a very painful, very painful condition where I guess the uric acid builds up in your, like, toe joint or other joints. And it was so excruciating. And that was in my other foot.
The supposedly healthy foot.
The healthy foot, right. So I had one leg that was, like, swollen and, you know, infected. And I had terrible pain in the other foot. And I kept saying, my other foot really hurts. This is, like, so weird. And the doctor came in again and said, I think you have gout. And they did the test, and I did have gout. You know, the uric acid was too high. So then I couldn't walk. I couldn't bear weight, you know. I was, like, really miserable because I had previously gotten up with a walker, using a walker. And, you know, another thing I really feel my years of practice have given me is such a strong sense of a path. So I thought, okay, I've got a path. I've got to get up twice a day. I've got to try to walk. I've got to do this. And it was really hard. One of my great lessons, actually, which I'll tell you in a minute, came from that first time I got up. But all of a sudden, I couldn't walk. So I couldn't get to the bathroom. And then it was just like, you know, it was such a regression. And there's such a sense of, maybe this is endless. This is just a loop, you know. So again, there's like future thinking, you know, like now I'm spiraling. And that was like a big feeling of a setback. And then my carbon dioxide was too high. You know, I don't even, you know, and suddenly they put me on another medicine. And then, you know, there was, they gave me a PICC line, you know, so that they weren't always poking my veins. And so then there's always like the fear of infection, and just like, you know, there's just a certain point where I thought, wow, I really have to get out of here.
And so it sounds like you had many of the reactions that us mortals would have, which is, you know, feeling demoralized or fear or the word propuncia, the mental proliferation, projection into the future, mostly in a sort of phantasmagoric way. You had all of that. We can't run a test to see the version of Sharon that hadn't been meditating for 40, 50 years to see what that person, how that person would have reacted. But do you think, is your gut that you had all those normal reactions that we would all have, fear, anger, whatever, but that they didn't stay around as long as they otherwise might have?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've, you know, in all those ways that, you know, if, you know, I was kind of describing, it'd be sort of like, if I didn't get tripped up in future projection, you know, which I did from time to time, but I wouldn't say all the time. Then it was a lot of stuff passing through me. You know, it was just like washing through me, and certainly fear came and anger, and there were things to be scared of. You know, and yet, you know, it wasn't a detour or a path that I really wanted to. You know, if I saw myself beginning to project, well, you know, what's going to be like when I'm back home? You know, like, I would say to myself things like, why are you rehearsing that? You know, why are you rehearsing catastrophe? Why are you rehearsing such a huge deviation from your life? And so that clearly is a gift of my practice, you know, is being able to catch the papancha, the proliferation, and say, maybe not. And also not have some horrific reaction against myself. Like, why are you thinking that? You've been practicing for God knows how many years. You know, it wasn't like that at all. And it was also, it was so interesting being in Santa Cruz. Like, one point a nurse came in and she was doing whatever, and she took a look at me and she said, I teach loving kindness to kindergarten kids, you know. And I thought, woo, this is really interesting. I got a glimpse of what's happened in these last 40, 50 years in this country. The respiratory therapist came in. I think they put meditation expert on my chart, you know. Respiratory therapist came in and he said, I've been meditating for about a year. Have you been to Insight Santa Cruz? I said, well, no, I haven't actually been there. And you were great, Chris, in case you're listening to this. And then he said, well, do you know Vinny Ferraro? And I said, yeah, I know Vinny really well.
Well, well-known meditation teacher, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, well, he's my teacher, you know. And so it was just fantastic to feel that, you know, that kind of movement into society. And these people work so hard, and I had so much respect for them, and to feel that they were supported in what they were doing, because that is not easy work.
In terms of your interior situation, I'm just curious, what about the pain? I'm not particularly good at pain, but one of the things in meditation is to try to have hack our kind of habitual response to pain, which is just blind aversion. When you had this screaming pain in your foot as a result of gout, what did you do in your mind?
There too, you know, there was a lot of experience I'd had sitting and looking at pain. If I wasn't distracted, you know, if there weren't a lot of people trying to talk to me or things going on, if I could just focus, then it was all right. You know, like, they kept saying, you know, do you want something for the pain? What number is the pain? You know, 1 to 10, and do you want something for the pain? And the most I ever took was like Tylenol or something, you know.
I go straight for the morphine.
Oh, God.
I've never actually had morphine, but I feel like I would.
But I, again, you know, it's just what it was. It was the thought of disability more than the physical pain that was scary. You know, I mean, I couldn't walk. And
you thought, maybe I'll never walk?
I thought, could it be that I will never walk? I mean, there's no reason with gout that you would never walk again. And my leg was, you know, being dealt with, but I couldn't walk. And then there's that thought, you know, like, what if this is the way it's going to be? It's like, whoa. So that would be what would trip me up probably more than anything, you know, because I'd had a life and a lifestyle, which was too much travel and too much other things, you know, and that had to change clearly, but how much had to change. And it was just like facing this big unknown. That was pretty scary.
What about death? Because there, you know, when you mentioned before, there were times when they said, well, this could go to your heart, it could go to your bones. And the obvious propuncia loop there is, I'm going to die. Did that happen? And how scary was that for you, especially given that contemplating death, at least theoretically in Buddhism, is a huge part of what's on the menu?
You know, I thought about having a different life or having a limited life more than I thought about dying. And maybe that was a way to avoid thinking about dying, you know, like come to think of it. I mean, I've done a lot of contemplation on death, and I would say that I had been maybe very particularly afraid of dying earlier in my life. You know, my mother died when I was 9, and I was brought up by my father's parents, and they were Eastern European, and so both culturally and for whatever reason, they never really talked about her again. They thought it would be too painful for me or something like that, and so the whole prospect of death was also cloaked in, is this shameful? You know, this is a big secret. This is a terrible thing. No one's going to help you. Life's abandoned you. You should be able to stop this. What is this? And it was years of practice that helped ease, I think, some of that particular burden, kind of, you know, psychological or conditioned burden. And then there's just plain old fear, you know, like... I had visited this friend in hospice not too long before I went out to California, and she said to me, when I get afraid of dying, I just say to myself, so what's happening? And I said to her, I know it's just a belief system, but I do believe in rebirth, and I realize that when I get afraid of dying, I'm afraid of doing it wrong. So I say to myself, you've done this before. You know how to do this. And so I realized that there in the hospital that I didn't think I was going to die. I mean, nobody was, you know, but that I didn't have to have like the right experience, you know, or make it be a certain way. I just had to be with what is. And I would laugh at that memory, like, I've done this before, you know, like I've done this so many times. And she had laughed at my saying it. I that was part of what, you know, when I would go there, like I would say, don't rehearse that. You know, you're kind of, you're putting all your energy into creating this scenario that doesn't seem that likely. You know, you're here, you're being taken care of, you're on antibiotics, or nothing's fit, no organs failed so far. Somebody sent me a link to a website saying that someone they knew who'd had sepsis found it very helpful. So, of course, I also got a lot of, you know, emails and stuff. Well, I had sepsis. You know, I almost died. You know, got to be really careful. The hardest part's the recovery. You could still die. but somebody sent me this link, and it was some site that I'm sure other people did find very helpful. So the first thing I had to decide was, because I didn't know which to click, am I an elderly person who's had sepsis? And I thought, I kind of am, actually. That was a shock, too.
How old are you?
I'm 66.
I guess that qualifies?
Yeah.
What's the cutoff for elderly?
I don't know, but like every time the nurses in the hospital would change shift and they would do report in front of you, which was interesting, they'd say she's a 66-year-old woman. I think, who's that? I'm like, oh, God, it's me. But I am elderly. So I clicked yes, and then the first thing the site said was something like, many people who've had sepsis report that they've lost one or two significant capacities as a result. And I closed it up, and I never looked at it again. And I would just keep telling myself, don't go there. You know, this is not a question of being unrealistic. This is just like, don't go there. You know, that's creating a world that you don't have to believe in utterly and kind of hold and let define you. And certainly now that I know all these people who've had sepsis, a lot of them are not limited, you know, or haven't lost capacities at all. So I thought, don't do that. You know, it was easy to do that, you know, because you're in a hospital, you're not wearing clothes, you're eating their food, you know, you're being defined by a lot of other people. But I just kept saying, don't do that. Just don't do that. When I would do that, it was miserable. You know, those were the places of all that future projection. Oh, what if I, you know, can never do this again? Or what if I can't teach? Or what if I can't do whatever? But it's just those years of practice that came through for me. As they do, which is wonderful, you know, and it was just like, you don't have to do that.
I don't know if what I'm about to say is going to resonate in any way, but I've often had the thought or realization on retreat that if I'm suffering, I'm not being mindful of something.
Mm-hmm.
Is that roughly what happened with you? In other words, you were suffering when you got lost in these projections, but actually when you had time to just focus on the pain and feel it non-judgmentally, there wasn't a lot of suffering, it sounds like.
Well, I think, you know, here you kind of have to make a distinction between pain and suffering, because mm-hmm. I'm also very much of the school. I don't believe that. I believe pain happens. You know, something's just hurt. That's one of my favorite slogans. Something's just hurt, and it's very unfair to say to ourselves, well, if I had a better attitude, this wouldn't hurt, or if I didn't resist it, you know, it's all my fault in a way. My bad thinking is making this hurt. I think something's just hurt, you know, but it's like that extra suffering we don't need. And that, I think, over and over again, I saw, oh, it's easy to fall into that. You know, you don't want to do that. And I was also, you know, so lucky. Like, it did not go into my heart, or it did not go into my bones, or, you know, when I had a problem, it could be addressed, and it was just a matter of time. Or, you know, so I can't swear that if things had gone in a, you know, worse direction, I would have been so capable. But I really just think it's like all those hours, you know. Even those hours, you think, why am I sitting here? You know, nothing's happening, or I'm just dealing with this knee pain. And it's like, it counts. It really counts.
Counts how?
Because I found strengths, or I found...
Oh, you were talking about all those hours of meditating.
Yeah, those hours of meditating, they really count. Because there were times, of course, I had to consciously bring in perspectives or strengths that I could draw on. You know, like, this will change too, or... But there were a lot of times when it just arose within me because I had practiced it again and again and again and again.
In other words, you're feeling the pain, and there's the raw data of the pain, and then there's the extra layer we add of, this is going to happen. This is going to be with me forever.
Yeah,
I will never get out of this.
Yeah.
But after all those years of meditation practice, you were able to sort of spontaneously realize everything changes all the time.
Yeah.
This is going to change too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an amazing gift you gave yourself.
Well, we do, you know. I mean, of course, it's not just me, and it reminds me of, you know, I was interviewed for, I think it was Good Housekeeping, which is really ludicrous. If you see my house, any of them. And whatever I had to say didn't ultimately make it into the article anyway. But the question was something like, how do you use mindfulness in a time of complete crisis? And what I said was, I wouldn't wait. Like, don't wait. And of course, people sometimes wait and they reach for something in the midst of, you know, the bottom's falling out and you're in the hospital and it's all scary. And even then, it might prove to be a resource or something helpful. But the truth was, like, you don't have to wait. And just like that time we put in, which does often seem inconsequential or boring or useless, it's like it does matter. I really saw that so clearly because there it was. You know, something was holding me up in a way so that this doctor could walk in and say, boy, you seem a lot better than your numbers.
I mean, first of all, I guess I have two things to say to that. One is, I was going to ask you, what are the lessons in your story for the rest of us? And I'm sure there are many, but that seems like a big one. That because I know a lot of – I hear from people all the time who feel compelled, I'm sure you're in this position too, to come up and confess to me their meditation secrets. You got to be honest with you. I only do it when things are going poorly. And then when things are bad – when things are good, I just drop it or whatever. And I often say, well, you know, doing it when things are good is – will give you the strength to have those bad times be less bad. So that seems to be a really powerful takeaway. The other thing that just came to my mind as you were saying that was a thing that your longtime colleague Joseph Goldstein often says about meditation, which is that you can view it as practicing for death, for the dying process. Mm-hmm. So can you be awake with a knee pain right now? And if you're a little thing that might come to mind as you're dealing with the knee pain is, if I can be with this, you know, can I be with whatever's coming at the end of my life?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Any response to either of those things?
Yeah. I mean, when, you know, the friend I had visited in hospice, when she died, Joseph said to me, we're in the queue, you know, like to die. And that's something we don't often think about. And we're so busy, for one thing. I am so busy. That to take a moment and realize, oh yeah, and yet, you know, I do feel. I had also told you I would tell you about when I first time I got on a walk, which I will in a minute, but I do feel something shifted, you know, from that experience as well. Even though I contemplate death and I, you know, I do that as an exercise, it was really like I find things don't stick in quite the same way. You know, I wanted, like, I'm writing a book right now, as I believe you may be too. And, you know, I just pick my head away from that computer now and then. But, and I hope it serves people. I hope it does well. But it's like, really, I mean, the thought of, you know, doing what people do and like checking the numbers on Amazon, I thought, I don't care. I don't care.
Well, I do that a lot.
Yeah, well, you didn't just get out of the hospital.
No, I didn't.
You know, so that was...
has that lasted? Because I often find that I get to the end of a meditation retreat. I had one almost about 10 months ago, and at the end of it, it was a loving-kindness meditation retreat with our mutual friend Spring Washam. And at the end, I felt like, you know, I understand everything about how I need to live my life from now on, and I'm going to everything's in perspective. And then, you know, I'm checking my Amazon rank, you know, a week later, probably less than that. But this sounds more powerful.
Well, I of course, my book hasn't come out yet, so we'll see how bad I am. But I feel different. You know, I feel that there has been something where it's just like, let's just have a good time. Or let's just, well, part of what happened was that the first time I got up to walk in the hospital was with a walker. And which is very hard, you know, and a physical therapist. And she said to me at one point, it's not a race, you know. She said, you'll go further if you just stop now and then and rest. And that's become my new mantra. It's not a race, you know. Because that you know, was a big thing. You know, like, let's do it. Let's get it done. Let's, you know, there's so much to do. Let's do more. And let's do it quickly. And then I say to myself, it's not a race. You know, like, who are you competing against? Yourself? You know, like, just relax. Do it. Stop and rest. So, you know, I moved. My friends who were saintly, you know, offered me their house when I was getting ready to leave the hospital. Or before, the doctor said to me, it's illegal to prescribe anything IV over state lines. You've got to stay in California. And nobody knew how long I'd be on IV antibiotics for. And, you know, it could have been months. It turned out just to be 2 weeks because I made a meteoric recovery. And she said, you can go into a skilled nursing home, which would be a really difficult experience, or work something else out. And my friends, like, offered me their guest house. Another friend offered home health care aides. And so I created this world in their guest house. And it was amazing because actually Bob Thurman wrote to me.
Eminent Buddhist scholar at Columbia.
Yeah, and he said, you know, whenever the Dalai Lama has a challenge like this, he goes into retreat. Why don't you go into retreat? And so I didn't go into, like, full retreat as we know it, but I had 2 months. I didn't. The only place I ever went was the doctor's or the medical supply store. And I practiced and I wrote and I hung out with my home health care aides who became my good friends. And I asked people not to come see me right away. I didn't talk to anyone on the phone. And it was really a restorative period. It was really important. And, my theme is it's not a race, you know, just do what you can do, do it at a different pace, relax, you know, have fun, keep breathing while you can. And so it'd be interesting to see how often I check Amazon when the book comes out. Right now, it feels like it's all right, whatever.
Stay tuned. More of our conversation is on the way after this. If the 35-year-old version of you was listening to this, had some way to listen to this interview back when, you know, she was starting to write books and, you know, you had already founded this Eminent Meditation retreat center and go, which you carried on for a long time. Would you have been able to hear it's not a race? Would you? And can the rest of us somehow operationalize this wisdom, or do we need to have gone through the particular hell that you went through? What do they say? Smart people learn from their own mistakes. Wise people learn from other people's mistakes.
Oh, that's a good saying.
Yes, I don't. I think I saw that in a movie the other day. Anyway, is that possible that we could incorporate? Because I find the idea of it's not a race very attractive. Because I am doing what you described before of let's do more, let's do it quickly, blah blah blah. Can I do what you're describing without somehow losing my edge or whatever?
Oh, I think so. I mean, that's, you know, the things I learned by the time I was 35, you know, through my teachers and through people like that was also enormous. You know, I've had a very countercultural life and definitely I think that's why we reflect on death, or that's why we listen, you know, to others having this experience and we pay attention. I'll also say that, you know, I was overwhelmed by the degree of love and care that came toward me. It had never been my intention to kind of do a widespread announcement of what I was going through, and somehow it happened. And
yeah, well, we did. I did a big thing on the show here.
Oh, you did?
Yes, yes. And there was something on your website and I heard from everybody.
I know.
So
I know.
Yeah, there was a lot of love.
It was enormous and so touching. And that really supported me too. I mean, it really, I felt so gratified, and I felt like, oh, you know, here's this kid who's a respiratory therapist and he's just learning how to meditate. You know, all the people who had to teach me breathing exercises were always so embarrassed, you know, like, oh, I can't believe I have to teach you how to breathe. You know, or the nurse who's teaching loving kindness to children. Or I thought, you know, I didn't set out to have a legacy. I wasn't that kind of person, and none of us were. You know, I was 23 when we started IMS, and
Insight Meditation Society.
Yes, thank you, the Insight Meditation Society. And it was, none of us could have imagined what would happen in this country or around the world in terms of mindfulness or the practice. And it wasn't like a vision we held, like, oh, we're going to have a worldwide, you know, impact. It was nothing. It was like, if we can make it through the year, we'd be so happy. And yet, it's what transpired. So I felt a degree of fulfillment and certainly gratitude, you know, as all that love came pouring in. And, you know, a lot of people sent me flowers, and there were so many that I just gave them. You know, I would, like, look at them for a little bit, and then I'd send everything away. Everything, I got given away. And somebody came in, I think she was an occupational therapist at one point, whose mother was in the hospital. And she said to me, are you the flower lady? And I said, my mom got four roses. It's like so great. It made her so happy. I was so moved by that. And I thought, well, that's a life well lived. You know, I mean, there's nothing else I can accomplish that will ever match that. And so this need to accomplish something is also like, wow, you know, I can rest too.
Wait, say more about that. So given the love that you received was a symbol of the fact that you had done great, you had made great contributions.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Okay, so drop the mic.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was just like sheer joy and gratitude, and it was overwhelming, really. So even though it had not been my intention that it would be on my website or that it'd be the only people I really was set on informing with, I had to cancel a whole bunch of things.
Well, that's why it was on the website.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so, but I just wanted all those organizers, those particular, I was also very, you know, like naive, like they tell me that I think the first night that I was in ICU, my friends were hanging around and, I was saying things like, well, I won't get to Jordan in 2.5 weeks, but maybe I can get to Paris by the end of the month. And
you had an engagement in the country of Jordan?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, with humanitarian healthcare workers, people working in the Syrian refugee camps, and I couldn't make it. And but, you know, the fact that I thought I was going to be in Paris in 3 weeks, and my friends were thinking, yeah, right, you're really delusional.
So what was your schedule? I mean, I've known you for a while, but and I know you have a busy schedule and you're somehow on Twitter and email like all the time, or at least seemingly all the time.
I am.
So you pump out a book every 5 minutes. So I know that your schedule has been crazy, but it's really crazy. It was really crazy.
It was
crazy.
Really crazy. And Joseph kept saying to me, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you're doing it. And of course I couldn't do it, but I was doing it, and I couldn't sustain it.
You're also 10 years younger than him, but still.
I'm
9 years younger than him.
Yeah, 9 years younger than he is.
Yeah, but he's very protective of his energy.
Yes, he is. Yes. He is, which is very smart. And he's always been a model like that for me. But and even now, you know, like I can't travel the way I once did. I'm teaching, I'm writing, you know, like. I certainly feel like I'm active, you know, and plus life is complicated, you know, everything in samsara seems to be Medicare is complicated. Like, how do I get this to pay for that? And it's just like, there's a lot to do just getting by. But, you know, when I get an invitation, my new mantra about that is don't answer right away, you know, because you're going to want to say yes, and you just can't say yes to everything. Just like, breathe a bit, you know, answer it a little later, and that's really important.
What was driving your high productivity, your peripatetic nature? What made Sammy run there? What was going on?
I think it was so many different levels. It was a level in which I was just grateful someone wanted me, you know, like wow, you know, they want me to come teach. That's amazing.
But that seems like I hear low self-esteem in there.
It could hear that. I mean, that's not an unreasonable assessment. I would probably have said not being in touch with kind of that feeling of how much I had done. You know, it wasn't that I wouldn't have been grateful, but I just didn't sit and receive, like, you know, you've done a lot. Like, this is, you know, it's not a race, you know, like, take it slowly. Some of it is that I get pulled in a lot of different directions. You know, there's a whole initiative, which I am now a part of, it seems, to bring tools of meditation and things like that to people whose lives have been affected by gun violence. You know, so it started out when I go into the Parkland community.
You went Florida. To Parkland.
I went to Parkland. And now there's going to be a retreat at the Study Center in Barrie for not only people from Parkland, but people from Pittsburgh and people from, you know, a small, obviously, retreat with an enormous number of people on faculty. Or when I was going to go to Jordan for the International Humanitarian Aid Workers. There are things that move me to do. And then there are other things that are livelihood, you know, really frankly. And then there, you know, there's responsibility to the Insight Meditation Society. And then there's this and then there's that. And I just was not good at really curtailing all of that. I think, oh, isn't that exciting? I could be involved in this research project. Oh, isn't that amazing? I can, you know, I can do that as well. Or like, wow, you know, it's only three flights to get there. Yes. You know, and if I stay away, then I can go from there to there. And it was just all wrong.
I really resonate with that. In particular, and this is probably projection on my part, the low self-esteem of it. Mm-hmm. Like, I wrote a book, and all of a sudden, nobody ever asked me to go speak anywhere. And then, like, now everybody's asking me to go give talks, and, oh, yeah. They want me to come talk? Yeah, fine, yeah. I'll go do it. And, oh, yeah, somebody else wants me to write a book with them, or maybe start an app, or, you know, maybe do a collaborative process with X and Y and Z. And mm-hmm. So you say yes, because, like, it's exciting, and you can't believe. And also, there's the remuneration. Like, people, meditation teachers don't make a lot of money.
That's correct.
And much of what you do relies on what's called dana, which is generosity, or in other words, people pay what they can. And sometimes that means they pay nothing.
Yeah.
And you do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, I think I know I am speaking for you here, but I think I'm speaking for you correctly. There's a deep belief in what you're doing and the need that other human beings have for this. I think I have less of that idealism, I'm embarrassed to admit, but I have some, but not as much, I'm guessing here. But I can see from my own personal experience how you would get into this situation.
Yeah.
Because I've done it, and it's gotten me into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, yeah. No, definitely. Well, you also have, you know, you have a family and you have other things. But yes, you know, I don't receive any money for the work I do with, say, Parkland. And I have an apartment in New York City, you know. Those things also need to be balanced out. And I had, you know, a book contract. Oddly enough, I have three books coming out next year because it's the 25th anniversary of Loving Kindness.
Which was your sort of seminal work.
Was my first book.
Yeah, the work that really, really helped put compassion meditation practices on the map.
You know, so that I just wrote a new afterword for that. The publisher of Real Happiness is reissuing it next year, so mm-hmm. I wrote a new foreword for that. And I have the book, which I've been working on.
Which is about?
It's mindfulness, loving kindness, and social change. So it's 8 chapters. I'm working on 7 and 8 simultaneously, and then the intro, and then I've got a first draft. So we're close.
But just getting back to the it's not a race, I'm just wondering, I asked this before, and I don't think we really chased it down. Can I'll just put it in, I'll keep it in the eye, as some people say in meditation circles. Can I mean, I haven't gone through a health scare the way you have, but could I, or could the 35-year-old version of you, or our listeners today who are out there thinking, well, you know, I got to make a living. It's not a race, sounds good, but, you know, I haven't done everything that Sharon Salzberg's done. I can't take in the magnitude of my contributions and kind of exhale. Is this operational for other people? It's not a race.
I think it is, you know, because I think we've all incorporated it to some extent or another, because otherwise we'd be completely crazy or I would have collapsed long ago. You know, I think it's bringing it more and more, because I think it has a lot to do with quality of effort, more maybe even than quantity of effort, because it's like I am writing and I don't feel I know in writing when I've been really in a bad state, I felt like just phone it in. You know, like this is your 8th or 9th or 10th book. It's like nobody cares what you have to say anymore. And I worked out of that state by getting re-inspired, but I don't feel that. You know, I don't feel like, oh, you know, I was in the hospital and I was so sick and who knows what could have happened. So let me just, you know, turn in whatever or, you know. It's not like that at all. I feel as, because you used the word edge earlier, you know, so when I think of edge, I think of excellence.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel as committed as I've ever felt to turning in something excellent, you know, to the best of my ability.
Why? Because you want it to reflect well on you, or because you think excellence will help more people?
I honestly don't think about how it's going to reflect on me at this point. I just think that's the way to do things. You know, like if you've got limited time, and, you know, this will be my 11th book. And I don't know that there will be any more, or certainly many more. And this is it's a little bit similar to the book I wrote, Faith, in that it's something that I very much have wanted to write for some time, and I got the opportunity to do it, and so we'll see what happens. But I don't feel like, oh well, you know, this person's book is coming out before mine, and they're going to probably say 50% of the same thing. So how unfortunate, you know. If only I, it's like, who cares? Honestly, genuinely, like, who cares? I don't think you have to lose your edge. I don't think – it depends on what your edge is, but I don't think you have to lose your commitment to excellence and to really shining in a way, and even ambition, you know, having that. But when it gets crazy, then it's ruining your life. You're trading in your life for some story.
So you can – strive for excellence, as one of my friend's dads used to tell us when we were little kids. He would say, strive for excellence. You can strive for excellence in the spirit of it's not a race.
Yeah.
So that you're not, while striving for excellence, making yourself and everybody around you miserable.
Yeah, I think that's true. Because I think it's incremental. It's like we've all done it to some extent. You know, that's the lesson learned. I mean, that's the thing I saw with myself. I thought, you knew that already. Why, you know, but how deeply do we know it? And we keep maybe learning the same thing again and again and again. We all have changed in some way. Could be worse is another mantra. Could have been a lot worse. But it's a continual process of growth and change. And so I think lessons learned, you know, like, we just continue to get better.
How's your health now?
I think good. I hope good. You know, like I get very tired. Less so though. When I went up to teach at the Insight Meditation Society in May, rather than a full teaching load, I appeared for an hour a day in the hall. I spoke, we sat, I did questions, and in some ways, it was the way to maximize my connection to the whole group rather than you know, maybe seeing a part of the group in small groups or individually, as one would often do. There were other people doing that. And I just taught this last weekend at Kripalu. I co-taught, and I saw I'm a lot less tired than I was in May. Hmm. But that's sort of the biggest marker, is that I just get really tired.
What would you say is the hardest part about this experience that has been contributory to your overall well-being? In other words, what's been the most valuable challenge? Was it stopping? Was it letting other people take care of you? Was it facing death? Was it all of those?
I think it was all of those in a lot of ways. Like, again, you know, like with the reflection on death, which is something I do, it can also be quite abstract until it's not. Like, I have a friend in Barrie, where the Insight Meditation Society is, where I always said, you know, the closets are a mess, and if I die and you have to clean them out, please don't judge me. So that was our pact, you know. And then recently I thought, you know, those closets really are a mess. Like, maybe I should clean that up. Or I had to do a health directive, you know, which I had not done, which Joseph kept saying to me, you need to do this.
End of life directions for caregivers.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and now I have one. And, you know, it's much more real than it had been before. It was not easy to let other people. It's still not easy to let other people take care of me.
And why?
It's just some conditioning. I'm used to taking care of other people, and it's like I find it embarrassing. You know, like, oh, you've got to. But
do you think it's rooted in some way in your personal history, where you know you lost your mother early, your dad, you lost him as well.
Yeah. Probably. You know. Yeah. I'm probably undoubtedly. You know that. And the way I got by was by making sure I got by, you know, mm-hmm. Like I went to college when I was 16. I was, you know.
You handled your business.
Yeah, yeah. And that's how I survived. So that's how I'm used to surviving. And
so what's it like when you can't handle your business? Can't walk?
Yeah, no, I was so grateful for like that nursing staff, because they, you know, I kept apologizing. I said, I'm so sorry, you know. I have to, and they'd say, no, you know. Whatever they were thinking, you know, they were incredibly gracious and generous. And my friends, you know, it was like, you know, people have then and continue to really offer me a lot, you know, and it's been very beautiful. And there's always this moment of like,
Isn't there a phrase in Buddhism, something about letting go?
Oh, yeah, that one.
So this seems like a pretty big exercise in letting go of control.
Well, I remember when Ram Dass had a stroke, and we were co-teaching once in Hawaii, and he said, he was giving a talk, and he said something like, of all the things that happened to me after the stroke, and now this is significant, you know, like he's been in a wheelchair ever since. It's been like 20 years. His speech, which had been like his superpower, has been pretty affected, you know, so when he gives a talk, there are long silences or whatever. He said, the hardest thing of all was letting people take care of me. And he said, one of my most famous books was called How Can I Help? He said, maybe I should write a book now called How Can You Help Me? Because, and he's been an incredible model for me as I've gone through this, because it was very hard for him. And he's so kind of porous now. It's just like love. He's so loving. And you can see he's receiving it and he's offering it. And it's not weird in any way. It's so flowing now. And so I think of that. But that's hard. You know, it's quite hard to be that different. And it was really hard to stop. Because...
Stop the forward momentum. Yeah.
Stop the forward momentum, because... people have very different views and levels of understanding of anyone's state, you know. And so, the invitations would keep coming in. Well, now that you've had a week off, you know, like maybe you'd like to come here. Or, I'm so glad you got back to New York. Would you come to my, you know, and those are all things that if I say yes, I would do because I was moved by them, not because they were helping my livelihood or sustain me, you know. And so there's a balancing act that's very different that has to happen now. And it's hard. It's hard to say, you know, I can't do everything I used to do, or sorry, I can't show up at your thing, or, you know, I will have just left Barry where I'm teaching for the first time in an extended retreat. You know, I can't then. Or, you know, somebody wanted me to do some extremely noble thing, which would have meant, this coming September, they're opening, the noble thing is that they're opening a kind of resilience center in Pittsburgh, you know, after there had been that synagogue shooting. And they're naming the resilience center something like House of Loving Kindness. And people wanted me to go and teach loving kindness. And it was like extremely noble. What would have meant, I'm teaching here in the city all day on that Saturday, would have meant teaching all day, going to the airport, flying to Pittsburgh, because Pittsburgh is not close, as it turns out. Teaching Sunday, you know, and I just wrote to the person. I said, those days are over. You know, where I'm teaching all day and running to an airport. They just have to be over.
You okay with that?
I am okay with that. I feel mixed, you know, because there's a place in me that wishes they were not over, that I could respond to that because it's so beautiful. And yet, you know, that would be crazy. I could just see like legions of disapproving friends. You know, like, what? You know, you're doing what? Well, I'm too scared to do that.
As we're heading toward the close here, I just want to make sure I didn't leave any boxes unchecked. Is there something that I should have asked that
I don't know? I didn't
ask? Let me just say this.
Do you want to talk about your hospice training at all? Is that
sure?
I'm very curious about that.
I'll say the thing I was going to say later. Well, I've been doing the hospice training for a couple of years with our mutual friends, Koshin Paley Ellison and Robert Chodo Campbell. And yeah, I still go. I think I'll be going later today. We're recording this on a Saturday morning. Originally, it's a small hospice in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And I would originally, when I was doing the training a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, maybe, I would go and really be a regular volunteer where I would go to all the rooms. Now, my volunteer training ended and I would have kind of let it lapse just because I'm so busy and Mr. Do One More Thing guy. I think you might be able to relate to that. But there was a patient in there who I don't think is going to die anytime soon. He's been there for 5 years.
Oh, my God.
Yes. I think it's like a world record hospice stay. And we're quite close now. And so now I go and just spend time with Ronnie. And mostly what we do is play violent video games, which is a little incongruous in a hospice. We're killing zombies together, but that's the way it is. He likes video games. And we have, you know, like on paper, nothing in common. He's a 61-year-old former construction worker from Harlem. But we just totally hit it off. So, yeah, I go in there pretty much once a week and spend time with him. And then I usually order dinner in for him and the staff. Yeah, it's really nice. Mm-hmm. And I will say, we talked a lot about death. I will say this. I'm still terrified of death, of course. I don't want to present some image that's incorrect, but I'm less terrified than I used to be because I see that at the end, most of the people I've seen are comfortable physically, and many of them are comfortable psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some people fight it, and that looks really tough. Or I've seen some anxiety set in, which looks really tough. But it doesn't feel wrong. You know what I mean? It feels like over time, I've started to see like, oh, yeah, of course, we're nature. And this is part of nature. Yeah. And we don't feel it viscerally, but you can get there by seeing it over and over and over again. It just starts to feel less wrong. Like, of course.
Yeah, that's amazing that you do that. You know, and because all of society seems geared toward, let's look somewhere else, you know, let's look the other way. And it's the wrongness of it. That's what I was trying to say about my childhood, you know, that the way things all went down made it seem wrong, you know, like alienated from nature. This shouldn't have happened. You know, this only happened to you. You know, this doesn't happen to others. You're isolated. You're alone. You're weird. And but of course, that's also what led me to Buddhism, because the first time I heard what the Buddha taught, it had to do with suffering as a part of life. And it was like, oh, right. You know, I do belong, that I'm not that alienated, that, you know. And one of the interesting things about being in the hospital is that partly because my father was in so many psychiatric hospitals throughout my childhood, and I would leave a facility and be on the street and think, nobody knows what's happening behind closed doors, you know. People are just walking around without some sense of, like, a whole level of society and what people go through. And I don't have that feeling that much anymore. And then when I was out of the hospital, I would think, oh, you know, people, you know, we drive by these places and we don't necessarily stop and think, oh, lots of stories here. When they moved me to an actual room out of ICU, the one whole wall was not actually a wall. It was more like a room divider or something. So I couldn't see anything going on in there, but I could hear everything, like every conversation. And there was a pretty rapid turnover of people in the next room. And so it was a lot of stories that I heard in a lot of different languages. And I think nobody, you know, driving by would necessarily think, oh, look at the intricacy of people's stories and how many kinds of people are in there and struggling. And, or, you know, when I would get up in the walker and walk by these other people also with IV poles, you know, and using walkers, and you think, who are you? Look at here. This is where we meet humanity. We meet in scary places and suffering and disability and facing death. And look how cut off we are usually from one another.
It's because we've structured society like Santa's workshop, where there's an island of misfit toys, right? So all the misfit toys are sent to an island. And we don't see them, but all we see are the working toys and the elves making them and all that stuff. And as soon as, like, something's messed up, it's very quickly sent away to inside the hospital or inside a nursing home or a hospice. And so most of us aren't confronted with this in any way until disaster strikes. But then the other thing that I've really noticed is how quickly habits reassert themselves. So you can have, you know, a friend of mine, her dad died recently, and she said it was like the tectonic plates shifted for her. Now, I don't know what's happened in the subsequent weeks, but I can imagine just reverting back to the old habits of, you know, momentum around taking care of her family and her professional life. I don't know that that's what happened for her, but I could imagine that happening for me. And I can also see what happens for me when I, even though I have a sustained, not episodic, vantage point on, you know, on the island of misfits toys, on the other side of the curtain, by going to the hospice regularly. And so once in a while, I'm walking down the street lost in my own, like, fog of to-do list or self-pity or anger or, what, you know, practicing some long invective I'm going to hurl at my boss. And then I'll wake up and be like, oh, my God, but I'm not, I can, I'm walking. You know, like, yeah. Well, how much would Ronnie give to be just walking down the street right now? But those moments are pretty few and far between.
Yeah.
Most of the time I'm caught up. And, yeah, so it's easy to have the realization, hard to make it last.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to want to give you more credit for those moments than I suspect you're giving yourself, because they matter too. And I think progress or change is always like that. You know, we take three steps forward, we take two steps back. We don't like those two steps back, and we grieve over that, but it's too, you know, it's not as far back as we once were. And those moments are really important, and they grow. They really do grow because I think we can get more mindful in an ordinary day, and then there are also the big challenges, and then it's there. It really is there, that kind of sustaining strength of a different perspective. And they say that one of the Buddha's pieces of advice, if you're sitting with someone who's dying or you're with someone who's dying, is to remind them of the good that they've done. And it always used to puzzle me because I thought, well, wouldn't that get them more attached? Like, because if you say you were a great cousin and you know, you took me to the park, you're supposed to be specific if you can be. And I thought that would be the last thing you want to do is get them even more attached. So they'll struggle. They'll suffer more. But people ask me, of course, a lot. And I've always said that, you know, this is what I've heard the Buddha said. And every single time people have come back and said it was perfect because instead of focusing on regret or the things undone or unlearned, there was just the sense of both the power of goodness we've been able to access and the joy of having not blocked it or hindered it in some way and, you know, expressed it and been a good cousin or, you know, you took the kid to the playground or something like that. And so I see a lot in that light, too, you know, that if we let ourselves rejoice more in the good that we have been able to do or the fact that we're committed or that we care about others or that you go to the hospice once a week, there are lots of places to go once a week when you work hard, you know, and the hospice isn't necessarily the easiest. And it's not like conceit or arrogance. It's like taking delight. It's really rejoicing. And the more we do of that, I think the less terrible those moments of backsliding seem. You know, they're real and maybe say something, but they're not the whole story, really.
And I can also see how it would lead to letting go. I mean, because it happened with you. When you received all of the love when you were having the health crisis, that allowed you to let go that allowed you to embrace it's not a race.
Yeah.
And I could see how at the end, telling somebody, hey, job well done, then they can drop their mic and say, okay, I can let go without struggling.
And, so maybe we have to do that before the end.
Well, you know? I mean, dying before you die is a theme I've discussed on the show before. It's just, can you take the wisdom that we often only get in those last and final moments and incorporate it into your life? I'm very interested in that. I'll just say in closing that and you certainly are welcome to say anything else you want, that, you know, I think what you were talking about before, that we can get better at these things, you know, you're referring to that I occasionally will wake up walking down the street. And we can get better over time. It just goes right to the animating insight of my meditation career, which is the mind is trainable.
Yeah.
And you've been training people's minds for a long time and made an enormous contribution, even in my own life, right? And I think coming here today and talking about this very painful, physically and psychologically, this painful episode in your own life is a very powerful teaching for other people. So I thank you for sharing it.
Thank you for inviting me. Really.
Thank you, Sharon. Love you.
All right. Love you too.
Okay. As we said at the beginning of the show, Sharon's doing the voicemails this week. We recorded this separately, but I think it'll be a treat. So here is voicemail number one, starting with Tori from South Carolina.
Hi, Dan. First, my obligatory but sincere thank you for your podcast and your books that I have not only read but reread several times. They are immeasurably helpful to me. So my question is a twofold question about meditation. I meditate regularly, pretty much every morning, for 10 to 20 minutes. My question is, how often should I incorporate metta into my daily practice? Is there like a prescribed amount? How often do you do it? Is it, you know, daily, weekly, or more circumstantial when perhaps you are having issues with a person? And my second part of the metta question is, I am having trouble holding visualization when I do metta. I've been listening to the Sharon Salzberg podcast, and I know that she prescribes that while you're thinking the meditation thoughts, you are to hold a kind of a visualization of the person in your mind. I have real trouble doing that for whatever reason, including my family, which I find kind of disturbing. But I wondered how important it is to hold a real visualization like that. I end up kind of getting fleeting thoughts of them smiling with light around them. That's honestly about the best I can do while I'm sending kind of thoughts towards them. Anyway, didn't know if that's something that I will get better with time, or if you have any words of wisdom of how I can get better with visualizing people as I am sending them thoughts, and also how often, you know, metta meditation is part of your daily meditation. Anyway, thanks for everything you do, Dan. Bye.
Hi, this is Sharon. Thank you, Tori, for both your questions, actually. In terms of how often to do metta or loving kindness practice, it's really up to you. When I went to Burma in 1985 to do a 3-month intensive retreat in loving kindness, that began a 4-year period where loving kindness was really my only practice. Each day when I was sitting, that's what I would do. And mostly that's not the case for people, and not the case for myself either anymore. I would suggest, though, doing it often enough so that you have a sense of confidence and clarity about the practice. And certainly, as you said, in different circumstances, it may be really the practice that you reach for. Often I actually find myself reaching for it when I don't know what else to do in some situation or connection with somebody. So it's really up to you. And I really honor the fact that you're putting some energy into it. And in terms of not being able to visualize, well, actually, honestly, neither can I. It's really an option. It's one way of having the practice come more alive for people, because we want concentration and we want a sense of focus, but we also don't want it to be rote or mechanical or to feel dead in some way. And so how do we get that sense of offering to kind of pop, that sense of there being a being that we are connecting to come more alive? And for some people, that is really through the process of visualization. Sometimes it's not. I usually try to offer the option of just say that name to yourself, the name of that person or being, if there's a single object. You know, with all beings, sometimes it becomes more of a global sense. Some people do have an image, say, of a planet. Other people, it's almost like this visceral sense. You can just feel this energy or some sense of connection that is happening. Some people actually do a kind of travelogue through the world and just get a sense of like, oh, here's this country, here's that, here's beings underwater, there's beings in the air, whatever it might be. But really, I don't think it's a question of somehow getting better at visualization. You might actually find that you are, but it's not really intrinsic to the development of the practice. So I hope that was helpful.
All righty, Tori, thank you for that, and appreciate you calling in. And now another one, voicemail number 2. This is from Max in Nebraska.
My question is with regard to metta, loving-kindness meditation. So I have the very, I think, common issue with it, that it feels very artificial, contrived to have this object with a repeated set of phrases that I'm repeating to him or her, may you be happy, may you be safe, etc. And that's not to say it doesn't work, that it doesn't get me to feeling that loving kindness. It just has that extra layer of sort of separation due to the artifice there. I find it easy to bring up that feeling, that loving kindness, even without that sort of artifice, without having to picture an object, without having to repeat these phrases. The feeling just sort of comes up naturally if I'm looking for it. And yet I imagine many people have been able to do that before me, and that the meta practice is still nonetheless to think of someone in particular and to send them these sort of directed, intentional thoughts. It's not simply calling up the feeling and resting in that. So I'm wondering, what is the particular benefit of having that sort of structure to it, having the intentional directed thoughts, as opposed to simply resting in the feeling? So any advice you have there would be much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Max, for the question. I think it's actually fine to simply rest in the feeling of loving kindness. One of the reasons that I've appreciated having a structure, and I appreciated also your use of that word, was that, first of all, I find that the sense of loving kindness may not even be a feeling always. Sometimes it's a worldview. It's a sense of recognition, like, oh, that person has more similarity to me than I ever might have imagined, or sense of inclusion where we used to exclude more readily, or maybe it's a full sense of connection because we're paying attention to someone we usually ignore, kind of look through. And so we utilize the structure, the phrases, or the sense of offering, of gift giving toward a particular being, very much in the sense of trying to enhance that. But absolutely, you can rest in the feeling, if there is one. And I would just say, maybe now and then experiment with using phrases or some sense of offering, just to see what happens. And especially for those times when the growth or the development and the sense of connection may not be captured by that particular feeling, because it's bigger than that. It's bigger than we can imagine usually, and there's more to it than that. And also, don't be discouraged if that feeling doesn't come sometimes, because that's a perfect place to actually utilize the structure of the practice and see what happens. Max, I hope that was helpful.
All righty. Thanks. Big thanks to Sharon for doing that, both the interview and the voicemails, which, again, were recorded separately. Also, thanks to Max for calling in. And on this episode 200, I just want to thank, again, I know I do this every week, but here's an extra heartfelt thanks to everybody. I really did not think this show was going to last this long. I really didn't have much foresight about what this endeavor was going to entail at all when we launched it, but I'm really happy that it exists. I talked about Lauren Efron, who was the founding producer of the show. She's since gone off to do other things within ABC News, but we now have a new – and so has Josh Cohan, who was the co-founding producer. Both of them have left the nest, but we now have Ryan Kessler, who took over the show many months ago and has done an incredible job. So, Ryan, thanks to you. And we also now have a few folks from 10% Happier, the company, who spend a lot of time and dedicate an enormous amount of energy and thought to this project. And those are Samuel Johns and Grace Livingston. And Grace, in particular, has organized a group of folks that I mentioned at the top of the show, the podcast insiders, who, you know, whose comments really inform how we do our work. So I want to thank all of you. And if you're not an insider and you're just a listener, I want to thank you as well, because without you, none of this would be possible. So thank you again. We'll be back with episode 201 next week.